أوكي، بسم الله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله وعلى آله وصحبه ومن والاه. We start as always by praising Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and sending blessings upon our beloved Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Brothers, sisters, ladies, gentlemen, relatives, colleagues, friends, it's very, very nice to see you here, especially my non-Muslim friends. It's absolutely fantastic that you guys can join us today. It means a lot to us Muslims for you guys to actually come here in order to engage with us and to learn more about Islam. So, Islamic Awareness Week. Just briefly going to go over Islamic Awareness Week. What is Islamic Awareness Week? Islamic Awareness Week is an opportunity where us Muslims can actually show you guys that we're not so bad. I mean, we smile, we joke, we give you jammy dodges, we buy you pizzas. Although we are a bit late sometimes, we will turn up eventually, okay? So thank you so much for your patience. Today, the topic is belief in Islam, is belief in God rational? Is belief in God rational? And today's guest speaker is Hamza Andreas Zortis. Yes, you can tell I've been practicing that. He is originally Greek. He converted to Islam, or accepted the religion of Islam, around 13 years ago, if I'm correct. And he's a very, very well-known writer, lecturer, and since these 13 years, he's been doing absolutely fantastic stuff. So it's a pleasure for us to have him here. He's also debated and had discussions with many prominent academics and intellectuals, one of them being Professor Lawrence Krauss. So without further ado, I'll present to you Hamza Andreas Zortis.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in alhamdulillah, wa salatu wa salamu ala rasulillah. Brothers and sisters and friends, I greet you with the warmest Islamic greetings of peace. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Which basically means, for those who don't know, may the peace and blessings of God be upon you all. Today's topic is, does God exist, or is the belief in God rational? So, is the belief in God rational? Now, from a sociological perspective, from a common sense perspective, or a popular culture perspective, we think that if something is not scientific, it's not rational. I just want to spend a few moments to really dissect that and show you that's not really true. Because science does not lead to atheism. This is the first thing we have to talk about. Science does not lead to atheism. Many philosophers of science say, like, you know, to even make a claim that science leads to atheism is irrational and illogical. Now, why do they make such a claim? Let me explain. Science essentially bases itself on a theory of knowledge called empiricism. Empiricism. Now, what's empiricism? Empiricism is the knowledge thesis that basically says you can only have knowledge about something or concepts about something if you have experience. Now, that experience can translate into direct or indirect observation. So, when we analyze this theory of knowledge, how does empiricism now imply God doesn't exist? Because by the very definition of God, He is not observed. He is not experienced from a physical perspective. So if empiricism just uses observations, just uses experience, then how can now empiricism deny that which cannot be observed? As a theory of knowledge, it is quite limited. It's like me, for example, saying, I know there are two rooms, right? And when I observe things in this room, it tells me what's in that room. But that's not necessarily true logically from that perspective. So empiricism can never, never, ever deny actually God's existence because it relies on observations or experience. Now you may think, Hamza, you are talking about a very crude definition of empiricism. You're thinking it's direct observation. Well, fine. Let's take the other kind of liberal meaning of empiricism, which is indirect observation too. If we take indirect observation, then how can that ever negate God's existence? It actually entertains the reality that a deity does exist, or a creator for the whole universe exists, because when it's based on indirect observation, it's quite, you're quite loose in your thinking. You can have an observed event X, and you could infer from X. You can say, well, if X exists, then something that created X exists. For example, this is why we use the design argument sometimes, when we say there are amazing laws in the universe. There are fine tuning of physical constants in the universe. And if they were changed by a hair's breadth, we would never have a life-permitting universe. So if that data is true, we can infer, reason upon that data to conclude, well, maybe there's a cosmic designer. So whether you take a crude version of empiricism or a liberal is the wrong word, but a more coherent version of empiricism that is based on direct and indirect observation, therefore it can never deny God's existence. In actual fact, it should just stay silent, or maybe suggest some evidence we can infer upon to conclude that God exists. And this is very critical, because sometimes, especially being brought up in the West and in our country, Britain, and on campus, we have this nonsensical notion that science actually leads to atheism. It doesn't, because if it rests on empiricism, which is the theory of knowledge that actually says that you can only form ideas about something if they're experienced, direct or indirect observation, then that doesn't necessitate God doesn't exist. We have to use a different theory of knowledge, because empiricism is restricted to the domain of observations. This is why Professor Eliot Sober, who's a philosopher of science, in his essay called Empiricism, he says scientists at any moment are restricted to that which they can observe. So I know this is a bit of philosophical mumbo jumbo, right? And it's a bit late, I do apologize. But let me just summarize it for you in a very popular way. Can there be a possibility of a future observation that was currently unobserved? Yes. We know the history of science shows us that we don't have all the observations. Our observations are always limited. We don't have an infinite number of observations. We don't have the total number of observations of a particular phenomenon. So therefore, even if you were to claim that empiricism or science can deny God's existence, there should be always the question of, actually, not really, because we can have future observations that deny our current observations because we never observed them properly, or we're yet to observe them. Now this exposes the kind of limitations of empiricism, and that empiricism can't conclude God does not exist. Let me give you another example. Another example concerning science, that science uses a certain thinking process called induction. Now what's induction? From a pragmatic perspective, induction is that you have a limited set of observations and you conclude for the next observation. Make sense? You have a limited set of observations and you conclude for the next observation or the entire set of observations. Let me give you an example. Say we all traveled to Wales, lovely Wales, and we had a question, a testable idea, a hypothesis. What are the color of sheep? We don't know the color of sheep. We want to find out. So we go to Wales and we count one sheep, two, 1,000, 2,000, and we stop at 5,000. That's enough data. And we realize that all of the sheep are white. So using induction, we have a limited set of observations, which is 5,000 sheep. We're going to conclude that the next sheep is going to be what color? White. Because that's what we have. We have that limited observation. However, that may not be true. And we know it's not true. What's the other color of sheep? Black. I'm the black sheep of the family, right? The other color of sheep is black. Now, what does this expose? Yes, it's a crude analysis of induction, but it just used this to stick into your mind. What it basically says is that there can be a future observation that denies previous conclusions. We've seen this in the history of science. Because the history of science exposes the fact that it's not static, it's dynamic. And that's the beauty of science. We love science, right? Especially Muslims, actually. And if you look and study the history of science, you have the likes of David C. Lindbergh. He's a historian of science, and he quotes that the first real scientist was who? Yes, it was a bearded Muslim. Would you believe it? And his name was Ibn al-Haytham. And I believe he wrote the book on optics in the 10th or 11th century. And he was like the first manifestation of a real scientist that had a real methodology with observations and analyzing the results. Whereas the Greeks previously, they were slightly a little bit more theoretical from that perspective, okay? So what we're trying to say here is that, you know, Muslims love science. And you know what Ibn al-Haytham said all the way, all those hundreds of years ago? He said, the reason I do the science is because I'm motivated by the Quran. Would you believe it? So the point is, science has its limitations and it's changing. It's static. It's dynamic, it's not static. And we see this in the history of science. For example, there was a disease called pellagra, for example. And that disease is like a skin disease. And the scientific community at the time said, no, it's to do with infection. And there was one scientist who said, no, it's to do actually with nutrition. But because it was a consensus and a community, they're like, no, you're wrong, you're backward, you're like a flat earther, right? You're wrong. But after a few years, they found out that he was actually right. And that goes to show, even though when we may have a consensus about something, consensus changes. We thought, for example, Newtonian physics and mechanics was absolute. It applied to every scenario. But we know there are two non-complementary paradigms now between Newtonian physics and quantum physics. They haven't found the link yet. So the reason I'm mentioning these things is for you to understand that there is no static nature to science, and that's the beauty of it. So when you look at induction and empiricism, you come to the conclusion that they can never deny the existence of God. Empiricism, because it deals just with observation. God, by definition, is not observed. And induction, because it's limited. You can always have a future observation that denies previous conclusions. I know I spent some time on this, but just to try and open your mind. Now basically, you don't have to take my word for it. Who am I? You've never met me before. And if you have, I hope it was a good experience. But the thing is, forget me. Listen to what I'm saying and refer yourself to epistemology, which in the philosophical discourse means the study of belief or study of knowledge. Refer to the likes of Professor Alex Rosenberg. He's an atheist, but a scientist. Refer to the likes of Professor Elliot Sober. Refer to the likes of, and I don't know if I could pronounce his name properly, Goetz, right? He's a very good scientist and a philosopher who wrote about the scientific method. So you have Western references for you to look at. I don't want you to think, hey, this guy's, you know, crazy. He's just picking things up and making them sound nice. It's sophistry. No, I want you to do your reading yourself. Islam doesn't believe in a fascism. I don't want to have this kind of intellectual fascism that you think what I'm saying is absolutely true. I'm not saying that. These are just humble suggestions to plant seeds in your mind so you can awaken new realities and you can think, you know what? Actually, Richard Dawkins is wrong. Because he has that kind of social narrative that science leads to atheism, which is not necessarily true, as we just discussed. So, moving on now. Do we have good reasons for the existence of God? Oh yeah. And I'm going to try and articulate some reasons, okay? The first reason I want to talk about is you. I want to talk about you. And me. I want to talk about us. The very fact, brothers and sisters and friends, that we have an internal subjective experience, I think is good reasons for theism, for the fact that a deity exists, God exists, a supernatural cause for the whole universe exists. Why am I saying this? Take this for example. It's called fruit whoosh, right? Apple and blackcurrant juice drink. Now, if I were to take the straw and basically put it inside and take a few sips, very nice, right? There is a likeness to that reality. What is it like for Hamza Zodis to have a fruit whoosh. What is it like? Does anybody know what it's like for Hamza to have a fruit whoosh? Let's go a little bit further. What is it like for Hamza to feel embarrassed by being late? What is it like for Hamza to fall in love? What is it like for you to have a biscuit? What is it like for you to have a coffee? What is it like for you to feel pain? What is it like for you to say to your mother that you love her? What is it like for you to have a strawberry? This question, brothers and sisters and friends, is simple but yet very profound. Neuroscientists, philosophers of the mind are confused about this question because it forms something called the hard problem of consciousness. The Guardian recently wrote about it at length, the New Scientist magazine, and you have academic discourse from the likes of Professor Altin something, right? I forgot his name now. Professor David Chalmers, Professor Antti Ravoncio, and many others, even Dan Dennett, the famous neo-atheist. They're discussing and trying to find out, how do we explain this hard problem of consciousness? And let me detail what this means. The hard problem of consciousness is that there is a likeness, a subjective experience of me or you to have a fruit whoosh. The hard problem of consciousness also includes that why do we have subjective experience from physical biological processes? So there are two elements to the hard problem of consciousness. Number one, what is it like? What is it like for Hamza to have a fruit whoosh? Or is it like for you to have a bar of chocolate? Number two, why do we have subjective experience from physical processes? And if you look at biological explanations for this and philosophical explanations for this, they cannot explain that reality. C'est impossible, as the French say. It's impossible. And this is why, brothers and sisters and friends, theism is the best explanation. Now you may think, hold on a second, this sounds like God of the gaps. It's God of the gaps. You don't know what's going on, so you squeeze God in there as an explanation. This has nothing to do with God of the gaps, brothers and sisters and friends. Because if we were to know everything about the human brain, everything, you mapped out all my neurochemical pathways, and there's not many of them, but you know, you mapped them all out, right? You would still never be able to answer the hard problem of consciousness. Number one, even if you mapped out everything in my brain from a neurochemical perspective, you will never be able to find out what it's like for Hamza to have a fruit whoosh. You will never be able to find out why Hamza has subjective experiences from cold, irrational, unconscious, physical, biological processes. So it has nothing to do with God of the gaps. It's not due to a lack of scientific knowledge. Think of it from a logical perspective. Even if we were to know everything about the brain, it will not give us an answer to the hard problem of consciousness. What is it like for you to have a strawberry? Why you have that subjective experience from cold, immaterial, rather material, biological, unconscious processes? Why? There have been some explanations. Now the biological explanations fail because they admit they can't address the hard problem of consciousness. But there are some philosophical explanations. And Professor Antti Ravoncio, in his book, Consciousness, the Science of Subjectivity, he basically says the reason we have to look at the underlying philosophical assumptions is because they actually manage, if you like, the biological explanations. They deal with the biological explanations. They are a foundation for the biological explanations. So I'm just going to quickly go through some competing explanations and why I think theism or God's existence is the best explanation. The first type of explanation, brothers and sisters, is called type A materialism. Big words, don't worry about it. Type A materialism basically says there is no subjective experience. There is no hard problem of consciousness. The minute we know everything about the brain is the minute we know everything about consciousness. So therefore, there is no hard problem. There is no hard problem. Your subjective inner experience is an illusion. We are biological zombies. Professor Dan Dennett, in his book Consciousness Explained, actually articulated this view as well. It was published in 1991, and I know his views have changed since, but this is an interesting point. He says, essentially, there is no hard problem of consciousness because there is no subjective experience. It's an illusion. Your free will is an illusion. You falling in love is an illusion. You having a sense of amazing subjective experience, having amazing hot chocolate, is an illusion. And it is no wonder Professor Antti Ravuncio, he discusses other philosophers of the mind, and they argued that Dan Dennett is only trying to explain away what requires explaining, which is the hard problem of consciousness itself. And that's why they said his book shouldn't have been called Consciousness Explained, it should have been called Consciousness Explained Away, because he's denying that thing which needs addressing, which is the hard problem of consciousness. So type A materialism is not a good explanation because it denies your humanity, frankly. It denies that you have subjectivity. What about type B materialism? Type B materialism, brothers and sisters, is quite interesting because it basically says there is a small epistemic gap. It's a big word, but what this basically means is we have a small gap of knowledge to gap between what's happening in the brain and your subjective experience. There is a small gap of knowledge, okay? There is a small gap of knowledge. Now, this is problematic because what they also assume is that the more you get to know about the brain is the more you get to know about subjective experience. Again, as we previously mentioned, this is not true. If I were to map out all of your neurochemical pathways, map them out completely, I would never be able to find out what it's like for you to have a pint of milk. I would never be able to find out why you have a certain subjective experience as a result of having a pint of milk. So type B materialism is not an answer. There's type C materialism. Type C materialism says there is a big epistemic gap. There is a wide gap of knowledge. And it basically says we don't have an answer, but we'll find out soon. That again assumes that the only answer you can have is a scientific explanation, which is not true, because we just discussed previously concerning type B materialism that even if you knew everything about the brain, you would never be able to find out what it is like for someone to have a certain experience and why that experience comes from cold, random, if you like, material, unconscious processes. So this leads us to type, so it's A, B, C, D, right? It leads us to type D dualism, also known as Cartesian dualism. Cartesian dualism basically says there is a subjectivity, a mind, and a brain. There's a physical thing called the brain, and there's an immaterial thing called the mind. Now this intuitively makes sense. Yeah, I have a mind and I have a physical brain. But there is a problem with type D dualism or Cartesian dualism, which is called the interactionist problem. Because the response from skeptics would be, well, how on earth does an immaterial mind deal with or interact with a material brain? And they just say, we don't know. So it's not a really coherent explanation on its own without God. And that leads us to type E, epiphenomenalism. Big word. If you could say it in one go, you can have my drink. Oh, come have the drink. So, epiphenomenalism. Now, what is epiphenomenalism? Epiphenomenalism is that, let me get this the right way around, that physical states affect subjective conscious states, but subjective conscious states do not affect physical states. I repeat. Physical states affect your conscious states, but conscious states do not affect physical states. Let me give you an example. I put my hand in the fire. The fire burns, okay? I have pain, the subjective experience now. But I move my hand not because of the pain, but because of some random accident. That's the nutshell of epiphenomenalism. That you put your hand in the fire, the physical state of fire causes the subjective experience of pain, which is fine. But But the pain, the subjective experience, doesn't call the physical state of me moving away. It's just a random accident. So every time you put you feel some pain and you go, ouch, that ouch is just accidental. It has nothing to do with the subjective experience of pain. Crazy, I know. Check it out for yourself. It's mad. But you want to be more spooky? Type F. Type F explanation to consciousness is also known as panpsychism. Sounds spooky, doesn't it? We're called the Ghostbusters now, right? You're probably not born in the 80s, but I was. I love the Ghostbusters, right? Remember that green guy? What was his name? Slimer. No one knows Slimer? This shows my age. I do apologize. I'm 34. I'm not that old, but older than you. Anyway, move that aside. So we have panpsychism, or type F monism, I think it's called. Now, panpsychism basically asserts, and this is the view of Professor David Chalmers and others, that panpsychism is that a fundamental law of the universe is consciousness, and that everything is conscious. We have an electron that's conscious. Hi, electron, I love you. And he replies, I love you back. I know that sounds really bizarre, but they think that this is a valid explanation for the fact that they can't explain the hard problem of consciousness, that consciousness is everywhere. Now, what's interesting is, when we think of consciousness, we think of a unified conscious entity. For example, how can you have thoughts without a thinker? So we have a unified conscious entity. So if this unified conscious entity is just an amalgamation of many small conscious entities, then how am I having a unified conscious experience? For example, this design on this drink, I'm not seeing all individual elements and they just happen to transpose on my brain. I see a holistic, whole, unified experience. But if panpsychism was true, then I should not only be an amalgamation of different small conscious experiences, but when I experience something like this design on the drink, that I should just be experiencing all the different individual elements of what it makes, or what makes it conscious, for example. Why am I having a unified sense of conscious experience? I should just be in an amalgamation or accumulation of these small conscious experiences, but I'm not. I have a unified sense of conscious experience. Now, you may think, what on earth is he talking about? Don't worry, if you don't understand anything, that's the whole point. It's so you go on to your library, type in Professor David Chalmers, type in Professor Dan Dennett, type in Professor Antti Ravoncio, so you study further. I used to be like that in the past, preach. I don't like doing that anymore. I like to plant seeds. I think that's the Quranic narrative, the Islamic narrative. Because sometimes the Quran doesn't even give you answers. It just gives you questions to lead you in the right direction. So, why is theism, God's existence, the best explanation? Number one, it explains conscious emergence, how we get subjectivity from non-subjectivity. As the physicist Schroeder, he said, there's no real difference between the brain of an Einstein and a lump of sand. It's just a rearrangement of carbon or molecules. What makes it different is that conscious awareness, that subjectivity. So how do we explain that subjectivity arose from objective, cold, unconscious things? It would follow that unconscious thing will come from an unconscious thing. A objective, cold thing would come from a objective, cold thing. How can you now argue that subjectivity comes from something cold? How can you say that this subjective state of awareness comes from something that's just physical and random and blind and unconscious? It makes sense that there was an all-aware being that created a physical universe with the ability for beings like us to have conscious awareness. And this is why, even if you study evolution, I believe there are a few academics in Portsmouth and Southampton who do amazing work on evolution. They would humbly say, we can't really explain consciousness, and we can't explain language either. So there are some gaping holes in many things, and that's the whole point of human progress. So theism explains that. Theism also explains how you can have immaterial things like subjective inner experiences interact with the physical brain. That there was an all-aware being with his all-abiding will that basically enabled physical and non-physical things to interact with one another. So from this perspective, we start to understand now that actually consciousness makes sense of God. The fact that we have inner subjective states makes sense of God. It's the best explanation. And what's really fascinating, you could summarize it in the following way. The minute you say, I am a Muslim, I am an agnostic, I am an atheist, is the minute you actually indicate the existence of God. Because who is this I? This I is me, you, with a subjective inner conscious state. How is that best explained? Not materialism, not scientifically. We talked about the hard problem of consciousness. It's best explained by God. So the irony is, the minute you define yourself and you say I, is the minute that God exists. So that's one argument for God's existence. Let me give you one more. By the way, I would like to give you seven, but it's getting late and I missed lunch. So I heard you had nice pizza, by the way. Liked it? Who had pizza? Was it nice? But what is it like for you to have pizza? The inner subjective experience. Anyway, the next argument I want to talk about is your brain, your rational faculties. I want to give you a question. Can you trust your mind on atheism? Now, Charles Darwin, he wrote a personal letter. And he said, if we just evolved like monkeys, then why should we trust our rational faculties? Why should we trust our ability to reason? Why should we trust our own minds to form conclusions about so-called truths? Because if we just evolved just like monkeys or any other species, then we shouldn't trust our minds at all. Because evolution via natural selection is about survivability, not truth value. It's about survivability, not truth value. So why do we trust our minds? Why do we trust our rational faculties? Which is a foundation for science. You can't say, oh, well, science can explain that. No, no, no. Let's not be naughty. You need a rational brain before you have science in the first place. We're talking about the assumptions of science here. How on earth can you trust your own gray matter in this skull? If you use evolution as an explanation, which I don't think is a good explanation. Because evolution dictates that it's just about survivability. Now you may think, well, to survive, you need to be clever. That's not true. Let me give you some examples. Say, for example, we went to the top of this university, we all went together, and I split the room into one half and another half. So you have half that's called A, half that's called B. Now you all go up to the roof, and I say to you guys, jump off. A, they're rational. They say, obviously not. I need to survive. This is a core instinct. I'm not going to jump off because I know gravity works, and I'm going to splat on the floor. Now, the other half B, no offense by the way, the other half B, they have some issues, to say the least. They forgot to take their pills this morning. So they're thinking, well, yes, I know I could fly because I know I have these metaphysical wings. So you're all just about to jump, but then you realize, hold on a second, I remember my mom, she overclipped my wings and they're not working today. So you survive based on irrationality. Irrationality can lead to survival. For example, if I told all of you to cross the A3, which is one of the crazy roads with no lamps, and you have to put your lights on, right? It's very scary. And to come to Portsmouth from London. So if I told all of you to cross the A3 blindfolded, what would you do? Group A would say, oh, of course not, because there's traffic, there's cars speeding down 70 miles per hour, sometimes more than 70 miles per hour. If I get hit, I'm gone. But the other group say, of course I can do it, because I have these special powers, and when something fast hits me, it just goes through me. But then you realize, oh no, Someone called Slimer, who's my ghost friend, he's super glued my shoes to the floor and I can't move. That's an irrational belief, that's untrue, but yet he survives based on irrationality. So we can't claim that survivability is, you need truth for survivability. So survival doesn't really necessitate truth. And let me give you another example in the animal kingdom. Who likes cockroaches? Nobody, right? But they're good examples though, because cockroaches, they survive and they reproduce, which is the drive of evolution essentially. It's about survival and reproduction. Cockroaches can reproduce more than anybody. Cockroaches could even survive a nuclear holocaust. Do you know this? But yet, you don't see cockroaches basically sitting in this lecture theatre and writing notes about the hard problem of consciousness. Because it's irrelevant to survival and reproduction. And this is the whole point. Why on earth do we trust our brains? We shouldn't trust our brains on atheism, on just evolution. Now, there's something even more interesting. Not only do we have a rational mind that we trust, but the universe is conceivable. As Einstein famously said, what is inconceivable about the universe is that it's conceivable, is that we can understand the universe. But how on earth do we understand this universe, brothers and sisters? Isn't it interesting that not only do we have a rational mind that we trust, but we have a universe that can be rationalized? I repeat, isn't it interesting that we have a rational mind, but we also have a universe that can be rationalized? It's as if there is a lock and a key. The lock is the rational mind, and the key is a rational universe. Locks and keys are not random. They're specific and they're designed. So it's as if, brothers and sisters, we are designed to discover. We are designed to discover. To this day, there is no naturalistic, evolutionary, scientific explanation for why we trust our own brains. Because it doesn't necessitate that it had to lead to truth. Because irrational beliefs, untruths, can lead to reproduction and can lead to survival. Isn't that interesting? So isn't it interesting it makes sense of God, who's an all-aware being, all-knowing being that created a universe with beings that can have awareness and knowledge and thoughts and rationality. And isn't it interesting that when you study the Quran tells us to use our intellect. أَفَلَا تَعْقِلُونَ Do you not use your intellect? يَتَفَكَّرُونَ For those who reflect. That God wants us to reflect upon His signs in the universe in order for us to understand that He deserves to be worshipped. Isn't that amazing? Hello? Isn't that amazing? Yes. For me, it's fascinating. So let me just end. Yes, I've given you some arguments, I've talked about science. Let me end with this. By the way, you need zero arguments for God's existence. let me explain why. I'm going to explain why in the following way. Can everybody hear this?
Yes.
Good. This is a table, right? Is this a table?
Yes.
Agreed?
Yes.
Good. Is this table real? Is it external to my brain? Prove it. I want you to prove that this table is real and is external to my skull. Guys, you're at university and you've spent more than 30 seconds on this topic. It's embarrassing. Is this table outside of my brain? Is it external to me? Is it real? Prove it. Don't just give me an answer. I said proof. Wait, one by one, hands. Yes. It's not attached to me.
Yeah.
How do you know?
Because
yeah, but maybe you thinking it's not attached to me could just be in here. Right?
It's an object,
but that object could just be in here. Yes, sir.
There's a consensus in the room that the table is not attached to your brain.
It's a ridiculous argument, no offense. Yeah. The argument by a consensus. You must be Greek. The democratic view. Consensus doesn't mean anything. Consensus always changes. We've seen that with the history of science. Let me explain something. I'll give you time after, so I do apologize. I'll give you 5 hours, okay? You can sit in my car as well, don't worry. So listen to this. That consensus could just be in my mind. You can all say to me, Hamza, we're all saying it's outside of your mind, silly. But me hearing, Hamza, that's we're all saying it's outside of your mind, could just be in my mind. Yeah, but that touching and feeling could just be in here, bro. Yeah, but that feeling could be in here. Yes, sir.
What's the use of thinking anything else?
Ah, but that's not an answer. That's a sidestep. It's like a good parry in Wing Chun Kung Fu. Bong Sao. I agree. No, I'm going to get to that. I actually agree with you. I'm going to get to that. See, the point of this discussion is to show that there are some things that we require that are fundamentally true, yet we don't have any evidence. In philosophy, this is called a basic belief, or you could call it a self-evident truth. And there are many self-evident truths. Like for science, requires the self-evident truth of the real world being real is external to my mind. That there are external causal things going on in the world. This is a necessary self-evident truth. And that's so fascinating. Not only that is a self-evident truth, but even the belief that our minds are rational is also self-evidently true. Also, the age of the universe is self-evidently true. Because for all you know, the universe could just be 5 minutes years old. And it was created 5 minutes ago with 18 years of memory. With you having 18 years of memory. You can't disprove that. At the end of the day, if you've seen The Matrix, maybe you haven't taken the blue pill or the red pill. Maybe my name is Neo. Right? See, the point I'm trying to say here, brothers and sisters and friends, is that there are some self-evident truths, or also known as, in the language of philosophy, basic beliefs. My argument is, God is also a self-evident truth. God is also a basic belief. What we mean by God is the underlying element of that definition, which is that there is a cause for the universe. That is a self-evident truth. There are some objections though. Objection number one. Hamza, if you believe God is a self-evident truth, I believe the Grand Fairy is a self-evident truth. Or the Spaghetti Monster is a self-evident truth with huge meatballs for eyes. That spaghetti thingy-majiggy created the whole universe. And I respond and say, no, you are wrong for three major reasons. Number one, self-evident truths do not require information transfer. Self-evident truths don't require someone telling you it's true. For example, the fact that I know this table is real is not because you told me, it's because I have my own intuition, internal experience, my introspection, which in epistemology is a valid source of knowledge, by the way. My own introspection, without any information transfer, I know the table is real. Just like within my own internal experience, I know that there is a cause for the whole of physicality. It's a self-evident truth that doesn't require information transfer. But the belief in the spaghetti monster, I need information transfer, particularly of Italian cuisine. Spaghetti, yeah? So that's why the spaghetti monster or the grand fairy can't be a self-evident truth. The second point is, self-evident truths, brothers and sisters and friends, are something called foundational. Like you have a foundation to a house for the house to remain erect. Foundational truths are truths that actually create other knowledge. Okay? They develop other knowledge and answer fundamental questions. For example, believing that the physical world is actually real allows us to have the scientific empirical worldview that answers questions of the how things work. But interestingly, the cause for the universe, the creator, is a foundation for why things work. Science can never address the why, by the way. We know this. If my auntie made you a really beautiful cake now, and I said scientifically explain it, you could just explain how long it was cooked for, what's inside it, the molecular structures, the peptide bonds, or whatever things that are inside. But they can never tell me why
she made it.
So God's existence is a foundation for the why. It's a foundation for consciousness. It's a foundation for even trusting our own minds. So it's foundational. But the spaghetti monster is not foundational for anything apart from a few laughs. The third point to reject this contention is that self-evident truths like God's existence and the physicality of the world being real outside of my mind, outside of your mind, they're not culturally bound. They're not via culture. For example, a spaghetti monster, if you were to say that to, I don't know, a Tibetan Buddhist, he'd be like, excuse me, a spaghetti what? It's not part of his culture because it's a culturally bound myth, truth, reality, whatever. But God's existence and the world being real, they're not culturally bound because they're cross-cultural. They're not a product of culture. This is why you have around 4,000 names for God since 6,000 BC Sumeria. A second contention is though, hold on a second, Mr. Zosis. Hold on a second. What about the flat earth? Didn't we believe the flat earth was self-evidently true? By the way, the flat earth wasn't a basic belief or a self-evident truth, but some atheists or agnostics or skeptics throw this as a question. I just want to address it. Fine, let's maybe admit the flat earth was a self-evident truth and it changed in the future. The point here is, so what? How does this refer to God? Maybe you can have future physical scientific evidence that denies your previous conclusions. That's excellent. That's the benefit of science, as we discussed in the beginning. But there's something fundamental here, which is future observations can never contradict God's existence. You remember what we said in the beginning? Do you remember? How can something that requires observation as a methodology deny that which is not observed? Because God is distinct and disjoint from the universe. If I created this table, I don't become the table. Likewise, if God created the universe, He doesn't become the universe. So that question itself is misapplied. The third and final contention is, you're wrong, Mr. Zosis. If it was so self-evidently true that God exists, then why do we have 50% of the Chinese people disbelieving in God, 40% of Germans? Why do we have around 750,000, nearly a billion, atheists on the planet? Why? So, self-evident truths don't require universal consensus. Self-evident truths can be individualized. For example, it's self-evidently true for me, from my own internal introspection and experience, that my mother gave birth to me. I have no proof. I don't have a home DNA test kit. I just have the say-so of my mother and my father. Even if I had videos and photos, I don't look the same. So I still have to believe that they said that was me. For example, in the morning, I had breakfast. I had a banana sandwich, and I had nuts with raisins, and I had a chai latte. So that's self-evident truth to me, but it's individualized to me, not to you. You have to access that information. So some self-evident truths can be individualized. And I would also argue that at the end of the day, if you look at the history of humanity, there is a broad consensus that there was a creator for the universe. So from this perspective, the contentions do not actually break down this argument that God is a self-evident truth. So where am I going with this? Where I'm going with this is the following. You can't, brothers and sisters, deny God. Because if you deny God, it's like denying the real world is external to your brain. The real world is real. Because the real world being real outside of your brain is a self-evident truth. God is a self-evident truth. If you reject one, it's like rejecting the other. Because they both have the same criteria. They're both foundational. They both are understood without information transfer. And they're both universal from that perspective. So, denying God is like denying reality. And this is in line with the Islamic concept of fitrah. The Prophet Muhammad, upon whom be peace, he said in a prophetic tradition that can be found in the compilation of Muslim. He was Muslim, but his name was Muslim as well. And this compilation, he basically collected a prophetic tradition that's authentic, where the Prophet Muhammad, upon whom be peace, said, every human being, every child is born in a state of fitrah. Now fitrah, the Arabic word, comes from the triliteral stem, fa-ta-ra, which you have words like fatrun and fatarahu, like something was created within you to acknowledge God and to worship Him and love Him and know Him. And this is in line with the self-evident reality of who God is. And this is supported by anthropological evidence. I have a lecture online, it's called Denying God, Denying Reality. If you put it on YouTube, Denying God, Denying Reality, I spent about 25 minutes on this particular issue. So hopefully I've given you some food for thought, planted seeds in your heart and mind to investigate and think about this very important question further. I have used relatively new arguments that I haven't used before in the past, so you don't have to go on YouTube and check me out when I was like 30 kilos heavier as well, right? So there you go. I really enjoyed being here. I mean, you could tell that these talks are just for me. It's all therapy for me. I like expressing myself, right? Because many of you are like this. What are you talking about, man? Which I don't blame you, but you know what? I want you just to be inspired to think further and for you to know that, you know what? Muslims are not stupid, right? Muslims like to think. We're autodidacts. We like to teach ourselves, read around. We may be wrong, we may be right. But the good thing about universities, and this is something I really want to focus on just the last 1 minute. The beautiful thing about universities is that we have a public space to articulate ourselves in a nuanced and compassionate way. And that's very important. We have to maintain that, even if we disagree with one another. Because I have to admit, the past Hamza Zordis was a little bit overzealous. And it's got me into trouble, right? Some ridiculous statements, right? But the point is, we learn and we grow. Britain should maintain that narrative that we allow people to learn and grow. And then we come together, even if you're Muslim, ex-Muslim, Jew, Christian, have that tolerance. I was in interfaith yesterday. You know what? I felt so loved, by the way. I was in Leicester, interfaith with Christians. It was beautiful. Kids were running around. There was Muslims there, non-Muslims. And it just shows that we can discuss. Don't hate, debate. Don't curse, converse. God bless you. Thank you very much for listening. God bless you guys. It's so nice you stayed here. God bless you. See you very soon, hopefully. Take care of yourselves and be safe.
Okay, thank you. Thank you guys. Just to sum up, I would like to thank Hamza for his beautiful lecture. Hope you guys benefited. Please, please keep an eye out for our next talks. I'm still mad at you. But keep an eye on our next talks. We've got another Greek convert coming tomorrow, if you're interested. But he actually lived in Greece, so I think you'll find that interesting. Okay, so Pam, Paul, I'm having a short note, and then I'll stop for a while.